In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with someone who is probably one of America's best-known champions of animals and the environment, Joan Embry. She serves as a Goodwill Ambassador for the Zoological Society of San Diego and has been associated with the San Diego Zoo for a long, long time. And I expect probably a lot of people who are listening to us this morning will have seen her on television and will know her from many years of appearances on The Tonight Show, where she would come and she would bring animals. Back when Johnny was the host and into the time that Jay Leno has been hosting the show. In addition, she spends a lot of time giving public presentations, traveling around the country, talking. She's here on the U of I campus for a visit that's sponsored by the Vet School here at the U of I. And does indeed have a regional connection, which we'll talk about here in a minute. She now makes her home in California. She has a ranch there where she lives with her husband and where they have a lot of animals, including a lot of horses. She raises horses and is a very accomplished rider in addition to all of her other activities. She's here visiting with us and I'm sure would be happy to take whatever kind of questions that you might have. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, welcome to the program. I'm really
happy to have you here.
I want to get you to tell the story of how it is you got into this field, first of all. And I mentioned the fact that that you grew up in San Diego and went to San Diego State. It is also true that you spent some time at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, which seems to me to be a long way from San Diego. And so I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about how it is, having grown up in San Diego and going to school there, that you then ended up in Charleston.
Well, you know, I tell people I've been learning my whole life. I've been going to school my whole life, and it's kind of a circuitous route when you consider when I graduated from high school, my goal was to enter veterinary school, and our veterinary school is in Northern California, UC Davis. And, of course, I went right up there and talked with the professors and soon found out that it was a very non-traditional role at that time for women. And, in fact, they may have had a woman in the class, an exceptional student nonetheless, and so I was told, you know, you really have to understand what's involved in veterinary medicine. This might not be the career for you. You need to, you know, understand what it entails. So I thought, well, I need to prove myself. So when I came back to San Diego, I thought, where can I get some good practical experience to show that, you know, I have what it takes? So if you think about it, in San Diego is the world's largest captive collection of wildlife, a very diverse collection. And I thought, well, there's a good place to start. So I trotted on down to the zoo's personnel office and put my application in and found out that 10,000 other people had done the same thing. The jobs were highly sought after. Now, in the zoological field, in the wildlife field, there were two positions open to women. You could be a secretary or you could work with baby animals because women were good at raising babies. So, of course, that was a no-brainer. I went for raising wildlife in an area called the Children's Zoo. So I applied. And, you know, just by luck, I guess, at some point when I was about ready to give up, the phone rang and they said, could you come in on call? And they had received some young baby elephants and they needed some extra hands. So I was on call. Now I'm going to college and I'm trying to get good grades and take the coursework. But now I have this opportunity to work with elephants, which I felt was equally important that I could prove myself in the field in some way. So it was a real balancing act. So I had to be available whenever they called me. So it was really tough to stay in school. Then as my career progressed, it turned out that I loved working elephants and, in fact, would trade all of my time with other girls who wanted to work with the small baby cats and primates and other things because they were intimidated by a baby elephant, you know, weighs 1,000 pounds. And even at birth, they're, you know, up into, you know, 400 pounds. So some of them didn't feel comfortable. So I spent quite a bit of time with them and began training them. They're incredibly intelligent. It was, interestingly enough, an elephant that led to my first appearance in national network television. And when you talk about television, there were only three networks at the time. Okay. So Johnny Carson really commanded a huge audience. So that launched me into television. So here I am trying to do my career. Then the zoo asked me to represent them as their spokesperson. And then I began traveling. And then I began traveling internationally. And so I'm having all these opportunities, but I'm trying to keep my foot in education. My first time in the studio, I said, wow, you know, what's a gaffer and what are they talking about? And I feel like I'm on another planet in the back of the studio. So I went back and took courses in public speaking, telecommunications, and then I'd go back and take courses that were related to things that I wanted to learn to further my goals in education. And actually, ultimately, that led me to somebody that I crossed paths with and met from Eastern Illinois. Her name was Shirley Neal. And I had all these units and all these classes, but I hadn't finished my degree because I was in and out of school all the time and taking classes that worked for me but weren't necessarily part of the curriculum. And I was so involved with a zoo that I kind of sidelined the veterinary aspirations. So I actually went to Eastern and I picked up the courses that I need in telecommunications and the coursework and taught summer school. So last night when I was giving my program, some of my students from my summer school class way back when showed up and said hello. So that's my connection. Then after 32 years of working in the zoo field, I felt like I just had kind of reached a spot in my life and my career where I wanted to broaden my outlook and I wanted to get out of the box. And so I left the zoo and started my own foundation. And I was looking around at how I could really look at all aspects of the challenges we face and do a better job of communicating what I felt were extremely important issues related to conservation and what people could and should do. And I came across a program called EnviroVet, which is sponsored through the veterinary school here, University of Illinois, and also UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. It's 3 weeks of intensive training, lab, classroom, and then 2 weeks in Africa at that time. And now they've been to Brazil, and now they are going to South Africa. So you're doing an international experience. And it was one-stop shopping for environmental issues. It was an opportunity to listen to professionals from all over the country, to meet students from different parts of the world, to hear different perspectives, and to really holistically look at the environmental problems we face. And it was really life-changing for me because I catapulted myself upon my return into really actively working with environmental groups and trying to see how I could leverage my years of experience into helping these groups accomplish their goals. So it's everything from the River Park in San Diego, working with EnviroVet, working with state parks in California, working with Project Wildlife, which does wildlife rehab, and learning to kind of help them leverage what they have to increase their reach and working with the communications aspect. Everybody needs dollars, and many of these groups have many volunteers who are interested but are led by one or two paid employees. They all need to reach the public, but they don't always know how to go about that. So that's kind of my specialty. Yeah.
Joan Embry's our guest here this morning in this hour of Focus 580 for now a long time, more than 30 years. She's been working with animals. She's also been doing education, trying to teach people about animals and their place in the environment and conservation issues and promoting a kind of positive interaction between people and animals. Long time, someone who's been many, many times interviewed on radio, on television, does a lot of public speaking, done this long gig on The Tonight Show where she for a long, long time would show up and bring animals on the program. She's here visiting the campus, her visit sponsored by the vet school, and we're pleased to have her here on the program. And if you want to talk with her, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I was really struck by your story about starting out at the zoo in San Diego, having this, you could be a secretary or you could work in the children's zoo. And I'm sure that what they were thinking of was cute girls, cute animals. This is a winning combination. And that's what,
yes,
you know, part of what you were doing was simply to be cute.
Well, if you look back when I started, I mean, this is the days of miniskirts and go-go boots, and women were beginning to look at, you know, forging their way in the workforce, but hadn't really arrived yet. And you were pretty much channeled into certain areas that were, I think, more traditional roles for women. Now the field is wide open. In fact, the veterinary school at Davis is predominantly women now, rather than men. The zoological field, from director to veterinarian, curator, keeper, all the way throughout, is equal, or close to equal, women and men now. So the opportunities are huge, which was what I was telling the veterinary students, how fortunate they are. the women, how wide open their opportunities are now. Mm-hmm. And I've not lost my interest in veterinary medicine. In fact, I've been to a number of the veterinary schools. I'm on the board for the Wildlife Health Center and the School of Veterinary Medicine, UC Davis in California. And it is an area that I think is evolving more and more into environmental and wildlife efforts. We need veterinarians to help us with our field work. We need veterinarians to evaluate our environmental health. And we're seeing a lot of movement from wildlife diseases moving into humans. A good example would be West Nile, SARS. You look at Ebola over in Africa. You look at bird flu. Monkeypox was another one that popped up here in the last couple of years. And so I don't think you can pigeonhole animals or veterinarians separate from humans. It's more of a holistic approach. And I think you'll see a lot more interface with medical doctors, human doctors, wildlife veterinarians, assessing environmental issues and in the future dealing with them.
Mm. I'm sure that for people who have a lot of experience dealing with domestic animals that you know, you can learn a lot and you can form bonds with them and you can get particularly a particular animal, whether you're spending your time with dogs or with cats or with horses or whatever, you get to feel like you know those animals pretty well. But I'm sure that dealing with a wild animal is completely different because they're wild. I mean, what does it take to be able to work with wild animals?
To work with wild animals, you have to understand behavior and you have to be able to read those animals. You almost have to be able to anticipate what they're going to do next or what they could do next and what motivates them to do that. So I ride horses, I show cattle, I train dogs, and I've worked the gamut in the domestic trade. The difference between domestic and wild animals is in the wild, those that react the quickest, respond the fastest, usually survive. So you have this innate sense of survival or state of alertness. It doesn't have to even be a real threat. It can be a perceived threat, something that in their perception, they read so quickly and they make that decision so quickly. And if they're frightened, they want to put distance between themselves and whatever would be a potential threat. And if they can't do that, they defend their ground. If you happen to be the person at the other end of the leash or next to the animal that's contained, you better have your guard up because the frightened animal is a dangerous animal. And that's when they use their horns, their teeth, their speed, whatever they have, their venom, whatever. So you need to understand what the potential is. You need to anticipate that potential, and you need to continually be aware of it and deal with it. You cannot be frightened and work effectively among wild animals. By the same token, you must be respectful of their potential.
Are there some people that you think just have a particular gift for that, and that either it's something about them or it's something that the animals can recognize with? I mean, I don't mean to get too fuzzy and mystical, but
no,
I do wonder
I
whether,
a,
you know.
It's an appropriate question because, well, if you think about animals, they don't communicate like we do by talking. They communicate by smell. They communicate by body language. They're very intuitive. And so when I talk about reading animals, I think that they read us. I think they read into people's uncomfortable state or people being nervous or aggressive or standoffish or what have you, and they make very quick evaluations. And if you are around, I've found in working with my animals, if I'm very calm and in control, it somehow translates to them. If I'm more jumpy and nervous, it can translate to them. You'll hear people that ride horses say the same thing, that horse can anticipate that nervousness. I think that some people have better intuition. People are always asking me to train them how to work wild animals. And I have to tell them, I really can only train you so much. I can have you work with me and I can show you how I work. But what you do is based on the response of that animal. And I can't write that in black and white and I can't write that in a book. I can give you some guidelines, but there comes a point that if you're going to be a good animal handler, you have to learn to read the situation and make minor adjustments. They can be very minor. You look at that animal and say, I don't think I'm going to push him any further. or you look at that animal and say, you know, I'm not going to get what I need here unless I, you know, push a little more. And that animal is uncomfortable, or that animal is very comfortable. That animal's happy, unhappy. And, you know, you can call that anthropomorphic, but really they have expressions, they have attitudes. Just how the fur lays on their back can be an indicator of their state of mind. So you learn to look at that, the expression in their eye. And I think you'll find veterinarians that work with domestics will find some of those same reads. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say that they have that kind of relationship with their companion animals, and that they, and, you know, who knows how much, to what extent it's true, but I'm sure there are a lot of people who would say, my animal knows how I'm feeling. And if I'm feeling bad, it seems that they're going to want to be, at least they're going to want to be with me.
Well, I feel the same way. I mean, my dogs are part of my family. I mean, they sleep on my bed. They go everywhere, ride the golf cart, get in the hitch wagon. I show draft horses and the dogs up in the seat and go everywhere. And I think they are intuitive. And there's a lot we don't know about animal behavior. So if you really study behavior, you're going to find some of those nuances. And it's through studying animal behavior that we're learning more about animals. For instance, in the world of science, when we wanted to breed animals, we began looking at genetics to determine who to breed and which animals to cross. And so the geneticists would pick out ideal animals for diversity within captive collections. Well, you pick two gorillas and say, this is a good match, but you put them together, they may not be compatible. It'd be like taking you and somebody, you know, one of your neighbors and saying, these two would make a good match. Put them together and say, you know, you'll make babies and live happily ever after. Well, the animals, you know, the behavioral aspects definitely, and surely with pandas, I mean, you know, they only ovulate and are receptive for a day or two. It's very important that everything's right. We weren't successful with pandas for years and years, and it was actually the behaviorist and looking at scent marking and how they responded to scent marking and their behavioral aspects of pandas that helped us. Sure, you need the endocrinology, the hormone levels, and lots of other things, but cheetah is another example. Behavior determined the success in rearing cheetah, because even though we knew the estrus cycles, it turns out that being solitary, the female cheetah defines when she's ready to breed and chooses her mate. So if you put males in close proximity but not in with her, she'll show signs of wanting to solicit a male, and maybe which male and at which time, and she pretty much calls the shots. And if you force that companionship or potential breeding, it shuts down her hormones, and she just actually will not breed. So all of the years that zoos tried to breed cheetahs by putting them together were totally unsuccessful until they looked at the behavioral aspects.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting. It points to, again, thinking particularly about the relationship between human beings and domesticated animals, to the extent to which that relationship has perhaps shaped those species. And I know there are people who would make the argument that for human beings to successfully work with the animals, the human beings have to understand the thinking of the animals. But it also goes the other way. And in fact, I'm sure people would say it's even more important that for the animals, for their success, to be able to understand the thinking of the humans. Because all that, you know, take dogs, for example, all the time they're watching us. They're wondering, what's going on with you? What are we going to do? What are you expecting from me? What, you know, they're very closely attuned.
They're social animals in the wild, and they would take cues off one another. So you become, you know, part of their pack, so to speak. You know, when I trained obedience, the dogs were never the problems. They got it. It was the humans that were hard to train. It really was. And the dogs do train their humans. They do manipulate their humans. And humans don't even realize it until you bring it to their attention, you know, that interaction and that process. And so they're incredibly intuitive. When you talk about how we actually select scents or behavior, well, that's true. I ride cutting horses, and a well-bred cutting horse is an incredible thing to see working cattle. And yet, you couldn't take other breeds of horses, and you may get them to follow a cow, but you aren't going to get that kind of read that a cutting horse intuitively knows. And so I think that we have defined, in a sense, behavioral patterns in selectivity, just as we have color and gait and size.
Yeah. You've had this very long association with the San Diego Zoo. And one of the things that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is zoos. And, you know, one of the things that over time I'm sure zoos have tried to do is to make their environments more like the natural habitat of the animals. But at the end of the day, you have to say, well, it's not like living in the wild. There's only so much you can do. How successful do you think the zoos have been in trying to make homes for animals that are like their homes? And then how do you deal with the criticism that, in fact, it is an artificial environment and maybe that's, you know, maybe we shouldn't have zoos?
Well, you know, I think we need to look at that and we need to look at these concerns. I think it is through zoos that people's consciousness of animals have raised to the point they are today. I mean, it is through that association and seeing animals that they have come to appreciate them. How many people have the opportunity to travel the world? And literally, in a collection of animals within a zoo, you, in spending an afternoon, travel the world and see those animals. Zoos have come a long way, and we still have a ways to go. And we need to determine and continually reevaluate what a zoo can and can't do and where we should focus those dollars and those efforts. Yes, naturalistic exhibits were done both for the animals from a behavioral standpoint to give them a better life, better behavior, more to do, create more naturalistic environment. It's also done for the people because animals were shown as collections, a monkey in one cage, a bird in another, a reptile in another individually. And now we've begun to more interpret the environment that we're not just showing an animal, but an animal is part of an ecological system. Those types of exhibits are very expensive. We're talking millions of dollars. So if you take one species, which is, say, a gorilla, and you spend $10 million to build that perfect exhibit, with the size of collections, it becomes very, very costly. And not all zoos have the gate or the membership or generate the dollars to do what they would like to do. Our roots historically were from menageries or private collections that grew within city parks. Then we took on education and interpretation, and now zoos are taking on field research and science and another added responsibility. And the cost of running zoos are large, and it takes a lot of public support. And I think their primary benefit is, number one, education. Number two is determining with highly endangered species how we can improve the situation. Learning normal values, normal blood values, behavioral values, how to work with these animals when they're in trouble. Let's take the California condor, 23 birds existing. Everybody at odds what we were going to do because we were losing those birds one by one, and they were on the verge of extinction and on their way out. Finally, they removed all the birds. They brought them into captivity. They intensively worked with the closest relative to that bird, the Andean condor, to develop protocols, which they then translated to the California condor. They pulled the eggs so that they would produce more eggs, optimizing breeding. They puppet raised the chicks so that they wouldn't imprint on people, and they have been in the process of releasing them. Population from 23, now up probably close to 250, flying again in Ventura, flying in the Grand Canyon, flying in Baja California. It took 20 years to get the first viable chick to survive in the wild. 20 years and millions of dollars and an intensive effort. The technology is there, the knowledge is there, but it also takes the dollars. And it is much more effective to save animals in the wild than to try and step in and do it captively. So the ideal situation is animals in the wild, surviving in the wild, but it may be that zoos are an important link to the people who can make those decisions, and to the science, gathering some of the science that we need to apply to both the wild and captive to highly endangered species, and solving critical problems that are developing related to the environment.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus. We're talking with Joan Embry. For many years, she was Goodwill Ambassador for the Zoological Society of San Diego and has this very long association with the San Diego Zoo. Has made many, many public appearances, been on television often. Probably some of the people listening to us have seen you on The Tonight Show. and or on other television programs. And she now travels all over the country talking about conservation issues, particularly interested in this program that she talked a little bit about, in the EnviroVet program that's here at the U of I at our vet school, also at
UC Davis. We work collectively on that program, which is 25 students a year, an incredible experience learning every aspect of the environment and how we're going to solve our problems in the future and now.
And she lives in California, has a little ranch there,
has
some animals,
ranch.
Have some horses.
Have a wildlife collection, yeah.
And she's here, and her visit here is sponsored by the U of I Vet School. She gave a talk last night about some of her experiences. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned talking about the fact that you went to, when you went to college, you wanted to go to vet school.
Right.
And that it was tough at the beginning. You were sort of discouraged because there weren't a lot of women doing
right.
that. Were you, did you want to be a vet? Were you one of these little kids who we would have asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you would have said veterinarian when you were a little girl?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My uncle was a vet, and I used to spend summers going with him on horse calls. And I was just fascinated by that, somebody that could, you know, fix animals, help animals, work with animals. I was so impressed. I mean, large animals and the work that he was able to do. And, of course, my own interest in animals over the years, every aspect of it, I saw that as a way to do something that really I enjoyed and could make a difference.
Let's talk to somebody here. We have a caller on our line one, someone on cell phone.
Hi.
Yes. Hi.
I have a question that has never been adequately explained for me about animal behavior. How can behavior be inherited? For example, the horses you raise.
Well, it's selection, just like you would select for color. So if you take, in a competition sense with cutting horses, those that score the highest dollars, that have the greatest ability, and that's both physical ability and cow sense. Will be selectively bred. And so you take that stallion and you collect that stallion and you breed many, many mares. And over a period of time, you keep selecting out that feature. You actually define that within the breed. And it's an offshoot of the breed. So if you take the quarter horse, you have the running quarter horse, you have the performance horse, and you have the cutting horse. Its roots were in ranch horses that were bred to be strong, durable horses to work on cattle ranches. But then when it became an arena sport, it became highly selected specifically for the attribute of cow sense.
So a behavior like catching rabbits from, you know, a dog catching rabbits is imprinted throughout the animal in its brain and its musculature and its...
You know, behavior is a relatively new field, and I'm not sure that we actually understand all aspects of it. But when you take a cheetah, for instance, has large eyes, hunts in the broad daylight, has a heavy brow ridge over the eye to shade the eye, has a flexible spine and long legs, all of these things allow the speed. But somewhere mentally in their mind is the intellect to put all of that together in an effective hunting mode to be a highly effective predator. So I think the mind is the least well explored. The physiology of the animal is the most understood, but obviously the intellect, if you look at, for instance, animals that rely on social structure, let's take, for instance, the hunting dog. A hunting dog could not survive. A pack of hunting dogs works like a team of football players with a game plan, with patterns, with collectively working, each one taking a role in the hunt to take down prey much larger than they are. So obviously their behavior in terms of how they work together is integral to the success of that animal apart from its physical attributes.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone else here. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, is that me?
Yeah.
I recently was watching the European news, and they had a picture of a chimp in, I think it was South Africa, who people had been tossing cigarette butts to, and the chimp actually got addicted, and they had pictures of it smoking, and it looked very much like a human would smoke, you know, it was blowing smoke out of its nose and into people, into other chimps' faces and stuff like that, and they couldn't figure out how to, they were having trouble trying to decide how to get the chimp off cigarettes. So my first question is, I was curious if you ever had a similar problem and how you would approach it.
Well, we don't give cigarettes to the animals. In fact, they're not given anything outside of their diet. But I can't understand how you couldn't control not giving cigarettes to an animal if it's a captive animal, or control people accessing cigarettes. Yes, they're extremely intelligent. They're like humans. I'm sure they would pick it up. They see a human do it and try it. And for whatever reason, over a period of time, they could get addicted just like a human could get addicted. But inappropriate use of cigarettes, you know, obviously a negative of human interaction with wildlife.
Yeah, I guess they don't monitor their the crowds at the zoo in South Africa too well, I suppose. Another question is, I was wondering why, with your experience, there's some sort of there's the feeling that some species don't breed in captivity. And I was wondering to what extent that's true, and I was wondering also whether you had any intuition as to why that might be. I know you talked earlier about incompatibility between particular mates, but I was wondering if you could bring that up to, like, the species level.
Well, there are many species for which we do not have sufficient knowledge, are in still a discovery stage of determining where those pitfalls. Let's just take for one example the diminutive dick from Africa. Zoos were having difficulties breeding these animals. They were imported from the wild. As it turns out, by looking at them genetically, you have subspecies with different genetic codes, different genetic numbers. So in the first generation, you can cross those animals, but in subsequent generations, you end up with hybrids that are sterile, much like a mule. And so that can be an obstacle because you haven't done genetic evaluations. You have animals that aren't capable of continuing to breed from a genetic standpoint. It can be a behavioral consideration. It can be a hormonal situation, not sufficient hormones, not understanding the rise and fall of hormones, not being able to predict appropriate times. Not all animals are social animals. They're independent animals and only breed at a particular time. And you need to understand all of these issues to be successful in reproduction. It can be an age factor, compatibility. There are a number of issues. And in zoos, the goal is to have self-sustaining populations. And then not only do you have to know how to breed, you have to know how not to breed. Because when you've reached your carrying capacity, that's the number of animals that you can care for, that you have housing for, that you have funding for, you have to think in terms of how you maintain the long term, but how you control the numbers. And so it requires intensive management to be most effective. And with some species, we're still discovering what the issues are. It can take years to discover some of those problems.
So there are species that are particularly difficult to get to breed in captivity, but for a variety of reasons.
For a variety of reasons, right.
You know, if I could ask one last question, and that is, I would think a zoo is stressful on the animals. And I know that there are theories that homosexuality in humans is partly due to the stress of, say, urban environments, that kind of thing. I was just curious if you saw any correlation there between, I imagine you do see some in zoos, and is there some sort of anything come out of your experience that you talk about that? No, I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
You're kind of out of my range now in terms of that would be something that a behaviorist would have to intensively study to see what evidence exists there, and that although my field is broad, that's not specifically my area. So I can't really address that. I can say that there's much yet unknown about wildlife, about wild environments, about ecosystems. And we are stepping in as humans to a management role as we greatly affect our world and our environment. And to manage something, you have to understand it. And so we're racing against time to answer many questions that we have about wildlife, because we will have to fix some of the problems we've created, and we will have to become better managers in the future.
About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me just introduce again our guest for anybody who might have recently tuned in. We're talking with Joan Embry, someone who for a long time now has been working to educate people about animals and about conservation issues. She was for many years the goodwill ambassador for the Zoological Society of San Diego, and has this long relationship with the zoo there in San Diego and goes back a long way. She travels a lot. She does a lot of public speaking. She has appeared many times on television, including a lot of appearances on The Tonight Show. She grew up in San Diego, went to San Diego State University, and ultimately spent some time in Charleston at Eastern Illinois University, and is here visiting the campus. Her visit was sponsored here by the Vet School at the U of I. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Caller here in Atlanta, Illinois. This is our toll free line. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got an animal that I'd like to ask a question about, particularly if the lady has more information than I do. One of my favorite animals is a coyote. And the reason that I think she might be interested in that, it touches all our lives a lot more than we think. I live in rural Illinois and have lots of coyotes on the farm here. I've been in the cattle business for 25 years, and all my neighbors are always asking to come and hunt my coyotes because they're such a danger to my cattle herd. Well, in 25 years, they've never bothered a cow. Matter of fact, it's the other way around. I've seen cows go after coyotes when they've threatened a calf. And coyotes are opportunistic. They're not going to do anything where they have to work too hard. The interesting thing that I need to ask about is the fact that they go back for a long time. There's evidence that they were in the tar pits, and they're really survivors. And they're lurking around everywhere, and I'll stop.
Well, you know, the coyote is an incredibly adaptive creature, and they've found in areas where they've tried to eradicate them, they've come back strongly. So that's not particularly successful. I think we do have to identify, when we live in rural interface wildlife areas, how we live in and among wildlife. In Africa, ranchers such as yourself live with lions and leopards and elephants and animals that are potentially difficult as stock managers, dangerous, and they pen their animals up at night. In California, we have not only coyotes, but we have mountain lions. And when people put hobby animals in their backyard, it attracts the mountain lions. And then we have problems with them taking livestock. And then they're killed on depredation permits from fish and game. So there's really a balancing act that needs to come about as to what is truly a threat, what isn't a threat, how we interface, and what we're willing to do as humans to provide for living with wildlife and not just decimating creatures around us. And the coyotes are great, and when you come to learn more about them and study them, they're incredible animals. And I think historically the concept of killing it because it's there or is a perceived threat, it's inappropriate, and we have to change those attitudes.
Well, another thing I'd like to ask you about, I understand that due to their environment, they'll regulate their own birth rate. I noticed on this farm over the long time that I've lived here that the coyote population apparently doesn't change much. It's regulated to what they can eat, and I
right.
understand that, you know, they don't, their population isn't going to be by control of their own in breeding to be greater than what their environment can.
That's absolutely true. And you can spend huge amount of dollars and great efforts and do great destruction. And coyotes are very resilient and capable of repopulating and coming back. I think they're best just left alone. Obviously, if you have pets, not cattle, but smaller pets, it's a consideration. Your pets should be penned up at night. They should be put in so that, you know, they're not taken. In Africa, the livestock that is vulnerable and the animals that are vulnerable are taken care of. It's just an assumption that you live in a wild interface, and that's part of your responsibility. But for some reason, people don't think the same way here.
That's right. I had a dog that was killed by a coyote that was challenging the coyote for a deer, a dead deer. And of course, the dog, there were several coyotes, and the dog was a small dog, and it lost. But I never, ever blamed the coyote. I mean, it was the dog's stupid misfortune of coming along the situation and going, you know, challenging the coyote. But it was the coyote's food and the coyote's territory, and you're exactly right. I really appreciated talking to you, though. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate talking to you, and I appreciate your attitudes towards wildlife, and I wish more people felt the same way.
Well, I think Carl raised an interesting point about the fact that it seems that we are having increasing interactions between humans and wildlife as people move into more rural areas, but also as wildlife, because of shrinking habitat, end up moving into urban areas. I would just the other day, there was an article I was reading, I think it was in the New York Times, about bears in New Jersey. They're having a huge problem with bears. A couple of years ago, they had the first bear hunt they'd had in New Jersey in 33 years.
Well, they had a bear walk into a hospital right through the doors that trigger by the foot action. And those are somewhat unusual, but they do occasionally happen. A mountain lion in somebody's backyard, a bear in a shopping center or an urban area. I mean, we're just kind of moving out and pressuring wildlife. And the wildlife biologists are looking all the time as, you know, how much pressure can these animals take? How do we mitigate these problems? How do we create a balance between humans and wildlife? But if we kill everything we see and we, have no tolerance whatsoever, then you can write off wildlife in every city except for key open areas in the United States.
Let's talk with someone in Danville. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Joan, I have read a bestseller, Life of Pi. Have you read it, and what is your reaction to it?
I have not read it. I wish I had more time to read, but no, I have not. Maybe you can fill us in.
It promotes zoos, and it talks a lot about animal behavior, so put it on your reading list.
I will.
Okay, that's all.
All right.
I will. I've worked in the zoo field for so many years, and zoos can do incredible things, but they're not a replacement of a wild environment, and we still have to think in terms of protecting nature in its purest form wherever we can. But zoos do what they can and are a great opportunity for people to learn. And that's what they should be considered as learning opportunities to see and appreciate wildlife. And hopefully animals won't require zoos as their only option for survival.
Let's go to line number two. This is a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I really live in downtown Urbana, or at least a block from it, about a half a block from the Boneyard. And we have a lot of groundhogs, and I think they're kind of cute. And when they started digging under my garage, we filled up the hole and put something over it, and it moved on. But my neighbor got some kind of license from DNR to trap them and exterminate them, and he thinks they're terribly destructive. And I wondered your opinion on that, because when I filled up the hole, it moved on.
Groundhogs do what groundhogs do, and they can be destructive, but so can raccoons and other animals who utilize their habitats and their environments. I think the important thing when you look at wildlife management is that the wildlife managers, whose mandate it is to deal with public concerns, have the best possible information in understanding population dynamics, population levels, survival rates, and all of the information to make the best possible decision as to what a reasonable take is, how many animals you can eliminate before you impact an environmental balance. And I think there's a lot of science to be done in terms of making those decisions. For instance, the largest loss of mountain lions today, and I use that because I work closely with that project, is from depredation permits. They've been hit by cars, but basically it's the take of people's hobby animals put in mountain lion habitat and permits given to kill the mountain lion as a result that has caused the greatest impact to their populations. We don't know yet what that impact is in terms of how many mountain lions can you take or can you kill because they're considered to be a nuisance or a threat to pets or livestock until we upset that balance and it starts in a spiraling downward trend. And it takes good science and field study to understand that. And that takes time and that takes dollars. So we need to support those efforts so those decisions can be made without a negative impact to the balance of nature. I actually have a groundhog. And so I love to hear your story because we don't have groundhogs in California. And I talk about it in my educational program. So if you have any great tidbits, you'll have to, you can email it to me.
We have one that we call Lard Bucket because he's kind of a chubby guy. But we have, I think we're on our about our fifth generation of him. But I just, you know, what is the likelihood of somebody's going to do a study on how many groundhogs you can keep in downtown Urbana?
Well, I mean, people do study urban, rural, and wildlife interfaces all the time.
Do they really?
Sure they do.
Okay.
I mean, here you have a university. You have students here. Maybe they'll hear that and say, well, I'd like to know more about groundhogs.
I hope so.
In our area.
I hate to see them gone.
I think that they're fascinating creatures. And the one I have does have a personality.
They do.
Yes. Yeah. You know, she has a blanket and she drags it all over and stuffs it in her house and creates her own little habitat and comfort zone. And she's quite a character. But so if you have any stories, email me at joan@joanhembree.com. So I'll have them to share with others.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, I'm thinking back to the fellow who talked about raising cattle and having coyotes. You know, I know that not that far from where we're sitting right now, there are coyotes and there are fox. They're a red fox. And I'm just waiting for the first story from somebody who lives in the middle of Urbana to say one day they looked out their front window and saw a coyote standing in their front yard.
That's possible.
This day is not that far away.
No, it's not. It's very possible. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at mountain lions, they're very territorial. This is true of other animals, species of animals. But so it's usually the youngsters that get into trouble because the males defend their hunting territories, their breeding territories, and so they force out the immature animals. And the immature animals don't have the experience, and they get into all kinds of trouble. They're like juvenile delinquent kids that are looking for their place in society or their way in the world, and they sometimes take the wrong direction and get into trouble. And it's unfortunate, but those are the ones we tend to have the most problems with.
Let's see if we can get at least one more caller. Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think I would like to say that my husband has his PhD in ecology from the University of Illinois, and he has been heavily involved. In fact, he's the director of many research projects that I don't believe the general public knows that the military has extensive training, or I should say research maneuvers going on in all the tens of thousands of acreage that the Army military bases have. And whereas these troops are being trained to run tanks and other pieces of heavy equipment and do other kinds of things to the environment, my husband and his group in the Corps of Engineers actually currently are working at an endangered turtle. And they've already researched and published the work that they've done with the red-cockaded woodpecker. And they have research projects all over the country. An interesting one when he first was with them was when the little baby turtles down at Cape Canaveral were refusing, or they were not going into the ocean where they should go because all the lights were being kept on all night. And
yes.
So they went down there and discerned that was the case, and Cape Canaveral then turned off the lights, and the little baby turtles are then returning to sea. But I think the general public doesn't realize the degree to which the military does spend money on protecting the environment, the soil studies, and the wild animal studies in all of the training areas that they have across the country.
And that's true out in California as well, where actually a bombardment range was completely redirected because it was determined that the loggerhead shrike wanted to breed in the bombardment zone. And so the Navy had to make major adjustments and bring in scientists. And these are federal mandates in terms of in environmental quality. And it's great to hear you talk about that work, because I think oftentimes, and this is one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in, the science that goes on behind the scenes, is published and is available to people who can find it, but the general population doesn't always understand what's going on in terms of science out there in nature. And it's a very important aspect of us understanding how to manage our world. So we need to support that science.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. We're at the end of the time. If you're interested in learning more about our guest, Joan Embry, or some of the conservation projects that she's involved with, you can go to her website, which is joanembry.com, and learn more. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here. We certainly appreciate it.